The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because
they are hard. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in today. Let's do a couple of quick announcements so we can spend more time with our guest. For those of you that do want to give us a call and talk to Barry Levin, it is 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners, so be patient, and I'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can also send us an email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. You can also post a comment or a question on the upcoming show page on our website. So go to thespaceshow.com. On the far right side is the upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. Open that page up. That is our archives for this show. And comments are down at the bottom, and you can sign in or you can comment as a guest. And as soon as you offer up your comment or your question, I'll get it and I can bring it up on air with our guest today. So those are the three ways you can check in with us today and participate in the show. Our website newsletter, which you will also find on our homepage, thespaceshow.com, will be available shortly after this program ends today. Do remember, everything is archived and you will be able to quickly download this program, or you can listen to it right off of our website. And upper menu, left side, there is a store under the support menu. For those of you who are interested in T-shirts and hats and things of that nature with the Space Show logo on it, do check it out. And there's also the Listen Live instructions. For those of you that want to tell other people how to listen live or listen via archives to the Space Show, and if you have questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do remember that everything we do is archived. There are a few exceptions to that, but they are there for you to download, or you can share the URLs with people, whatever works better for you. There are just a couple of restrictions about doing that. One is not to do anything commercial with our shows. And number two is not to do any editing of the shows, putting edits up on your own page or any other website, including Yahoo, YouTube, excuse me. And then, in addition, written transcripts are not permitted, even if those transcripts are intended for your own use. We appreciate your following those guidelines. Our full copyright statement is at the bottom of every one of our website pages, as well as the pages for OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we urge you to check them out. If you have questions, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't forget, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And we are able to bring you these programs because many of you do financially support and contribute to the Space Show. And we're deeply appreciative for that support. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. The same is true for those of you paying California taxes. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com, or check with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And again, your support is very, very much appreciated. Podcasting is through Gigadial. We're in iTunes. You can find the subscription RSS URL on our website, both our short email newsletter and our website newsletter. If you have any podcasting questions, don't hesitate to get a hold of me by email as well. We do have sponsors for our program. I urge you to check out our sponsors' banner ads from time to time. We would not be bringing you this show without our sponsors' support. for the first part of the Today Show. The Space Finance Group is a sponsor, and this is a team of space advocates with crowdfunding experience. Members of the team have helped raise over $1 million through crowdfunding, and they want to help you get the funds you need for your project. If your space idea can move forward for under $250,000, crowdfunding can be an ideal solution. We're the only crowdfunding team that specializes in space projects, and we understand space because we're the people behind the Integrated Space Plan. We understand your audience, the audience you need to reach. Go online at spacefinancegroup.com and email them at jay.witner@thespacefinancegroup.com. And remember, no buck, no buck Rogers. And then also for the first part of today's show, the first segment, the Space Foundation is a sponsor, and they have their 33rd symposium coming up. This is the must-attend space industry event, Colorado Springs, Colorado, April 3rd through the 6th, and their website, spacesymposium.org. And that brings me to our guest today, and Barry Levin is back with us. This, I believe, is the third program in our series of back-of-the-envelope programs, Fourth Industrial Manufacturing for Space Development and Related Topics. And I would urge you to check out Barry's full bio on the website, as he's been a guest and a caller to shows in the past. And we will continue this program theme for as long as all of you out there show a lot of interest in it. So let's talk to Barry and see what's on the agenda for today's Back of the Envelope program. Barry, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
I'm fine, David. How are you doing?
Doing okay. And so where are we with our Back of the Envelope discussions? What's in store for today? And I know you added some material on the blog. If people go to check it, you'll see a new edition from Dropbox there from you.
Yes. Regarding the Back of the Envelope theme, the first thing I want to start out is by emphasizing that, as all of us realize, we haven't been making the expected amount of progress since the Apollo flights in the from 1969 to 1972. And I wanted to use the back of the envelope techniques to examine that and to ask why this is. So that's the first thing I wanted to talk about. Then I wanted to talk about the Fourth Industrial Revolution, what its meaning is, how it can contribute to progress in space, and what kind of relationship it bears to the problems that we've been talking about regarding joblessness, technological unemployment. And the next thing I want to talk about is how people in the audience can become involved. And I want to go over the different tools of the Fourth Industrial Revolution, why they're a great opportunity for entrepreneurship, and how people can become involved, and particularly how people with space-related interests can make use of these technologies to further their own plans.
Okay, jump right in. Go for it.
Okay, well, the first thing I wanted to address is, you know, where do we stand progress-wise regarding all of our desire to become spacefaring, which is the theme of your show and which is an interest of mine. My interest in the space dates back to when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, and I was inspired by the space program, and I wasn't inspired by the school system, but I was inspired by the space program, and I became interested in technology, and I've made my career in technology. I do sort of grassroots level engineering. I do computers. My business is based on building and servicing computers, and I'm now exploring the possibilities of building actual manufacturing hardware based on the technologies that I hope to talk about. But I want to link this to my interest in space because the space program inspired me to learn, and to a certain extent, I owe my financial viability to the space program, so I feel I have an obligation to the space community to keep expanding that because it made a great contribution to my life. So I wanted to start out by just saying what my interest is, where it comes from, and now I'll get into my views as to the current state of the space program. We know that we last visited the moon in 1972. Eugene Cernan was the last man to step on the moon. He recently passed away. But if you look at the current state, we actually have, nobody can disagree with this, we actually have less capability now to go into deep space than we had 50, well, it was not quite 50 years ago, but it was 45 years ago. The total cost of the Apollo program was about $140 billion. The total cost of Saturn V launches for launch vehicle and the launch vehicle prep was about $1.5 billion. If you compare that with SLS, which is a vehicle of at least potentially comparable capabilities to the Saturn V, the projected yearly maintenance costs are $3 billion plus an additional $1 billion per launch. So rated at two launches per year, the total cost is $5 billion, so it's $2.5 billion per launch, which means that we're less efficient in launching payloads into deep space now than we were in 1972. Now, the next there's a few comments I want to make about this. Obtaining information about the exact cost of space launches is not easy. A lot of the information is proprietary. I've gathered the basic information from as many public sources as I could, but I don't have access to the private documents of space companies, so I can't claim that my knowledge of space costs is greater than anyone else's. But based on publicly available information, the cost of Saturn V launches was about $1.5 billion or $1.25 billion, and the cost of projected SLS launches is $2.5 billion, and that's not proven yet. So we're not only not going forward, we're actually regressing in our space capabilities. And in another way of looking at this is, what is our ability to launch manned space vehicles now? It's zero. We don't have any. I mean, Elon Musk is potentially a game changer, but we don't know how, we can't be sure of that. It's a private venture getting into areas which are traditionally governmentally financed, so we'll have to wait and see on that. I'm an Elon Musk enthusiast, but I think we have to restrain our enthusiasm a little bit and wait to see how it comes out. The basic point is that we do not, after 45 years from the moon landings, we have less capability now than we did then. And now I'd like to offer an explanation for that. I think the explanation for that goes back to the origins of the space program, which are based in the competition with the Soviet Union for national supremacy. And this gave birth to what I call heroic engineering, which means that we were going to push engineering to the absolute limits, and cost was not that much of an object because national security was a basic issue. I think we still, to a certain extent, live in the age of heroic engineering. And it's a tribute. The Apollo program was a fantastic engineering success. To go from Alan Shepard's flight in 1961 to landing on the moon in 1969 was incredible technological progress. It's actually hard to imagine how that happened. However, there was a cost to it. We relied on extreme and heroic efforts. There were 400,000 people employed in the project. And the result of that was an incredible success in landing on the moon, but it also had negative consequences of committing us to a cost structure that in the long term has not proved sustainable. So I want to put forth the idea that progress in getting access to space will be through the Fourth Industrial Revolution, which is the opposite of heroic engineering. The Fourth Industrial Revolution strives to make advanced manufacturing mundane, so it moves in the opposite direction. Its goal is to eliminate all labor from manufacturing and therefore eliminate the costs involved, the exorbitant costs involved in going to space. For instance, another back-of-the-envelope calculation. What is actually the cost of labor in building a launch vehicle? Take, for instance, the Falcon 9. The dry weight of the Falcon 9 first stage is 23 metric tons. The alleged cost, and again, this is a rough approximation, is $30 million. What is the cost of the material? It's basically made out of aluminum. Aluminum costs $2,000 a metric ton. If the cost of the Falcon 9 was strictly the cost of the aluminum, it would be 23 metric tons times $2,000 is $46,000. So 99.9% of the cost of building space hardware is labor. And I use that term generically because it involves the cost of capital, it involves renting workspace, but basically it's the cost of building the vehicle, which is enormous. The end purpose of the fourth industrial revolution is zero marginal cost manufacturing, which means you can manufacture the item for the cost of the materials. And I think this is the main point I have to make, that in the space community, it is generally taken for granted that the way to reduce the cost of space access is by radical technical innovation, thermal nuclear upper stages, nuclear solar, a la Franklin Chang Diaz's nuclear electric propulsion. I think that this is mistaken, even though it's a widely held view. Because these technologies, thermal nuclear, nuclear electric propulsion, these themselves are all heroic technologies, and all these heroic technologies involve heroic expenses. The difference between that approach and the approach of the Fourth Industrial Revolution is that the Fourth Industrial Revolution promises to make manufacturing a completely mundane activity. In other words, that we can make spacecraft for the cost of the materials in the long run. I mean, I'm obviously exaggerating here, not because I think that we're going to make space vehicles for the cost of the aluminum. But we are going to move in that direction, and we are going to, on a year-by-year basis, drive down the cost of industrial manufacturing to get at least an order of magnitude improvement in the cost of space hardware in the next 20 years and two orders of magnitude over the next 40 years. That's the point I want to make.
Okay. So, and you contend that cost is going to be driven down by automation, I guess, for a shortcut.
Yes, I contend that the cost can be driven down by automation, artificial intelligence, robotics, connected devices, and we can go into that because there's some confusion as to what the technologies of the fourth industrial revolution are, and I posted a document which just gives some examples of the different tools of the fourth. But the point that I make, and I just want to emphasize this, even though I'm repeating myself, because I think this is non-intuitive and non-obvious. The space community has a belief that radical new technology will drive down the cost of space exploration. I disagree with that, and I think history is on my side. Because if you look at the evolution of space technology, it's really what we have now are still glorified V2s. That's a bit of an exaggeration, and I'm exaggerating just to make a point. There has been, since the beginning of the space, let's say we trace the beginning of the space age to the launch of Sputnik 1 in 1957 by the R-7, which is now the Soyuz launch vehicle. The Soyuz launch vehicle is still flying now, 50 years after its first launch, and it's still a competitive launch vehicle. There has been no radical technological innovation. You could make the case that cryogenic upper stages, a la hydrogen-fueled upper stages, are a technological advance, but I don't think that's the case because SpaceX is challenging the economic model, and they're not using cryogenic fuels. So I think there has been absolutely no technological innovation in space. There has been heroic engineering, and the people who work in aerospace and engineering for Boeing and SpaceX, they're tremendous engineers, and these companies have tremendous expertise. And I further want to make the point that, which I intend to make later in the show, that these companies are an asset to the United States because they have a tremendous amount of inherent know-how. And I want to make the case that that in terms of our economic and industrial future, know-how is critical. So for those who have had a hard time explaining what the value of spacefaring is to the country, it's in the production of know-how, and know-how, the ability, the knowledge of how to actually make physical objects is the most fundamental skill that a nation has in maintaining its viability. So those are the key points.
Okay.
And we need spacefaring as a way of producing new know-how, and by using the already existing engineering capabilities and marrying those to the potential of the fourth industrial revolution, we can produce as much know-how as we need to make the space program viable in the future and to make our economy viable in the future. So the space program, the fourth industrial revolution, and the future of our economy are tied together.
So your first email of the day is from Jerry in Nashville. And Jerry says, the space economy is but a tiny part of our overall economy. And I think you are really out of touch, because we are seeing a national political policy emerge and put into place to bring back manufacturing jobs to hire American laborers that were shipped off seas years ago. These laborers are not coming into fourth industrial manufacturing jobs. They're coming into more traditional automated factory types of jobs. And who knows what the effect will be on product pricing down the road, as American labor with benefits and overhead is still pretty costly. But if you're talking about trying to get rid of labor costs, you're in direct odds to the national policy of the country. And I don't think space can stand alone. It's just going to be a tiny part of the overall U.S. economy. Your thoughts, please.
Yeah, I agree with what Jerry has to say. I didn't mean to imply, since this is a space-oriented show, I am addressing my ideas toward the space community, that I perhaps gave the mistaken impression that I think the space technology is a fundamentally huge part of the economy. It's not. Jerry's point is well taken. Jerry's point is also well taken that the national policy to bring manufacturing back to the United States is contradicted by what I'm saying about the fourth industrial revolution. The fourth industrial revolution is going to automate jobs, and I am skeptical of any national policy that says we're bringing jobs. Manufacturing itself may come back to the United States, but that doesn't mean the jobs will. So Jerry makes a point, but I want to address this issue as a fundamental part of the show today. What can we do about the apparent contradiction that Jerry has so wisely pointed out? There is a contradiction. The goal, the trend of the fourth industrial revolution is to eliminate labor from manufacturing. So Jerry has very astutely raised the point, you know, what, there's a contradiction here. There is an apparent contradiction, but it's not really a contradiction, because the fourth industrial revolution, as Jerry pointed out, takes away with one hand. It automates manufacturing, and it takes away manufacturing jobs. However, I hope to make this point in the rest of the show, it takes away with one hand, but it gives with the other hand. What it does is it democratizes advanced technology, and it makes manufacturing available at the level of the home. I'm going to make the case that the fourth industrial technologies, which include 3D printing, by the way, there was an excellent show by the Horvath and I forget the other fellow's name, Joan Horvath and the other fellow's name. You know, that was a really good show. But the point I'm trying to make, and that Jerry emphasizes, that Although the Fourth Industrial Revolution takes away jobs, it also creates the opportunity for entrepreneurship on a level that hasn't existed before. The technologies are so powerful and so cheap that I think that cottage industry can be brought back to the United States on a massive scale. That's the point that I hope to make, that the Fourth Industrial Technology creates problems, but it also creates opportunities. And what I hope to convince people is that a small investment of time in investigating what these technologies mean and how they relate to the various interests that people have can have huge payoffs in terms of entrepreneurial opportunities, job opportunities, and the ability to create viable new economic chances for people and new niches. I'm a firm believer that even though if you look at it on the surface, okay, the Fourth Industrial Revolution, artificial intelligence, CNC machining, 3D printing, genetics, this is all going to take away jobs from people. On the other hand, it also creates tremendous opportunity, and I'd like to be able to investigate the opportunities today, and particularly with regard to this interest that people have and how it relates to space interests. As Jerry pointed out, space is only a small part of the economy, and addressing Jerry's concerns, I did not mean to imply that space is a large part of the economy. It's not. But it's an interest of this audience, so I'm trying to approach the problem through the interests of this particular audience.
Okay, you already have a caller on hold. Hi, caller. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hello, this is Jack from Virginia.
Hi, Jack. Nice to hear from you.
Hi, Jack. This is Barry. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you? I'm really enjoying the show, and I just wanted to make the point that I kind of wince a little when I hear folks talk about measuring our progress in space technology by how far out humans have actually gone. I was pretty young after the late Gene Cernan took his last steps on the moon, and I remember all the books about the solar system back then had paintings of what they imagined, or what the author imagined the surface of the various planets to look like. And somebody buying a similar book nowadays, you've got photographs. And, you know, that might be a better way of laying out our progress or measuring our progress than just, you know, suggesting that it's only measurable by how far humans have gotten out into space. I know what the surface of Pluto looks like, and I didn't have to contract cancer in order to get there. And I just wonder if we're looking at it the right way, or if
I like your perspective. I think that's a good perspective. I'm looking at it. I originally got on David's show because I was exploring the so-called back of the envelope calculation to measure things, and I think that the robotic space program is and also space telescopes tremendously successful. But my point is, what do we mean by access to space? I operate a small engineering operation, and what I mean by access to space is that people like myself and people I know, I have a lot of acquaintances and business partnerships in the engineering community. We could be making our own spacecraft, except we don't have access to space because the launch cost is $2,500 a kilo, and that's optimistic. If the launch cost were $500 a kilo, I could build and launch my own spacecraft. That's what I mean by access to space. And I take your point. It's well made. We are making a lot of scientific progress, but the level at which you need to exist in order to get access to that progress is very high. Yes, JPL launches the space missions, and it costs, to get Curiosity to the surface of Mars, costs $2.5 billion. I think it's worth it because of the scientific payoff. But in terms of low-cost access to space, forget about how far men have gone into space. how far can I go into space? I have the engineering capability to make primitive spacecraft. I can't get them into space. That's what I mean. But I take your point that we are making a lot of progress in terms of our scientific goals.
And I agree with you with regard to the additive manufacturing and the elimination of labor will ultimately make it cheaper to do something in space or to do things on the surface. And spacecraft right now are in the most labor-intensive products that you find. I mean, they're all practically bespoke designs, each and every one of them, because you're only building a handful, if that. And, you know, if you had to build your Android phone that way, it would cost millions of dollars, if not more.
I think you ran on target, Jack. That's the point I'm trying to make is that these fourth industrial revolution technologies can dramatically reduce the cost of access to space. But I'm also trying to make the point that in addition to reducing the cost to space, which is important to us but not to everybody, it offers the opportunity to avoid the worst aspects of technological unemployment because it can also generate tremendous economic growth and opportunity. So that's a key thing that I want to make. And then I also want to make the point that the fourth industrial technologies are so broad in their scope that anybody who has any interest in technology at all can find something in the fourth industrial toolkit that they can personally use within a relatively short period of time and for a relatively small investment in their own personal financial portfolio.
I agree. And thank you, gentlemen, for giving me the opportunity to participate in the program. It's very interesting.
Thank you, Jack. I appreciate hearing from you again.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye. Listeners, that opens the line for those of you who would like to give us a call. It is 1-866-687-7223. Have you thought of any opposition coming your way from labor unions?
Well, I mean, I don't personally have. Yes, I think that there will be opposition from labor unions, but it doesn't matter. I don't mean it doesn't matter in the sense that people who are in labor unions don't matter. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that the historical trend and these technological trends are so powerful that even the political power of labor unions cannot stop this from happening. But they could, I mean, there's a positive side to this. They could invest some money in retraining people to take advantage of these technologies because in the document that I posted in the show notes, I've shown that it's quite cheap to become involved in very advanced technologies. 3D printers can now be made. There are kits on sale now for less than $200. You can make your own 3D printer. So the idea that there could be a 3D printer in every home in the United States is easily achievable. And what does this mean? That means that people, this is all going to sound a little far-fetched, but it's not because I'm doing this right now myself, and I'm involved with people who have 3D printers, and we're sharing information, and I will get into the specifics of what I'm doing if people are interested in knowing about it. But the cost of, here's the thing that's fantastic about the fourth industrial revolution. The cost reduction in 3D printing is exponential. I'm sure the listeners of this show are aware of so-called Moore's Law, where the cost of computer processing power halves every 18 months. This is exponential increase in power. The takeaway in terms of what is the meaning of the fourth industrial revolution, in one sentence, the meaning of the fourth industrial revolution is that the fourth industrial revolution will do for atoms and bits, cars, planes, and trains what computers did to information, make it exponentially cheaper. So that's the meaning of the fourth industrial revolution. things get cheaper. And the example of this is the 3D printer. If you wanted to buy a 3D printer 20 years ago, you were talking about $50,000 or $100,000. If you want to build your own kit now, you're talking about $200. If you want to buy a consumer-grade 3D printer, you're talking about $700 to $1,000. So the cost in 20 years has come down 50 or 200-fold, depending on whether you want to make it yourself. So in the manufacturing sector, where computing and mechanics are easily duplicable, we are talking about exponential drop in costs. And the next phase of that is to do for consumer goods, cars, refrigerators, spacecraft, the cost of those will eventually come down exponentially as well. So that is what the fourth industrial revolution means. Get around
better. What the heck was that?
I don't know.
I got a caller on hold. Maybe there was something with the line. You want to take the call real quick?
Sure.
Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
This is Marshall, and I'm down here in Saxe.
Okay.
Hello, Marshall. How are you?
Yeah, just fine. I used to do a lot of military projects, and if I remember my military numbers correctly, there was the mil standard 2167A, which laid out how the military went and did projects. Now, of course, this was ancient history now. I presume they're up to, like, version GHM or something like that. But is that the big difference between Elon Musk doing the work and the government doing the work, is just the bureaucracy of doing it and the procedures?
That's a huge point you're making. This is very important. The advantage of the fourth, one of the things that I didn't mention about the fourth industrial revolution is that network effects take place. Assume that you have a 3D printer that you've built for $200. I come up with a design for a I have actually built a biological microscope using 3D printer and optics. You now have to do no labor. All you have to do is, there's no planning involved. All you have to do is download my model, you plug it into your printer, and with no organization, no labor, you've printed out a fairly advanced technological object. So the use of sort of crowdsourcing, the ability to take the best work of thousands, if not millions of people, and apply that to any design problem that you choose, can take away the entire problem of organization and make that cheap.
Mm-hmm. The problem is, it's the government that's providing the funds to do a whole lot of these, and they require following the military standards and the bureaucracy up front. So it's like, ouch.
But Elon Musk and perhaps you and I, we're not bound by those standards.
Well,
and
I'm not bound anymore. I'm retired, but yes.
What?
I'm retired, so I'm not bound by it anymore.
No, but, even if you – well – here, suppose you were back working for the government on government contracts, and you decided, and now you're in the economic marketplace, and you've decided, you know what? There's too much bureaucracy in the government. I think I'm going to take advantage of the new manufacturing technologies, and I'm going to start my own startup. You can do that. In the 30 or 40 years ago, if you really wanted to do these advanced engineering projects, the government was the only game in town. It's not.
There was a total lack of computers.
but the government is not the only game in town now. The fourth industrial, I could build you for probably under $1,000. A 3D printer, a laser cutter, a CNC mill, laser engravers for under $1,000, and then you could build very, very advanced projects based on that. So this directly addresses the problem of government bureaucracy. You don't like the government bureaucracy? Do it yourself. And the multiplicative effect of the fourth industrial revolution is that individuals can now do themselves what only large organizations used to be able to do. So to answer your direct question about mil-spec, No, if you're working for the government, you can't control that. But what you can do now that you didn't used to be able to do is that you can compete with the government.
Well, how do you compete on distribution and marketing with the government as an individual?
Well, you have the distribution channel of the Internet and the web. Let's say I'm making a biological microscope, a real-time biological microscope. I can, I haven't decided whether I want to turn it into a product or not. But if I decide to turn it into a product, I open up a website and I start advertising, and the cost is nothing.
And you assume that you will find a sizable number of potential customers that actually.
I don't know, but the cost of finding out is not great.
Yeah, it's very affordable.
Yeah, you don't know. I mean, if I come, we can go over some of these projects and whether they're economically viable. I don't know whether it's economically viable, but the key thing is that it's cheap to find out. I don't need to hire an advertising agency. I open up a website and say, here's a biological microscope. If you want to examine your blood for parasites, part of the biological microscope is a centrifuge I've built. You take a small blood sample, you stick it in a centrifuge, you put it under a microscope, and you find out if you have parasites. Whether people are interested in doing that or not, I don't know. I suspect increasingly they will be. So I think there's a huge market for medical devices in the home, and I'm exploring that in terms of doing a startup of my own. But getting back to Marshall's point is the government bureaucracy is not as powerful as it used to be because now there are massive alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember doing projects by standing up and drawing on a chalkboard and trying to sell military officers on the idea and how to flow chart stuff out and so on like that.
What was your area?
We have CAD, and it's kind of like, hey, that totally eliminates it. But I don't think the military procedures have ever been upgraded to require that kind of thing. You still can just sell it by standing up and doing it.
I don't do military contracting work, so I can't answer that question. But I can answer it indirectly by saying that the competitive forces are so enormous now that I think they'll be forced to change their practices.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Hey, Marshall, you retired. You're no longer farming actively anymore?
No. I retired from high-tech computer geeky stuff. I'm kind of stuck at farming and repairing old buildings.
Marshall, I plan to talk about the applications of fourth industrial technology to farming. I'm a big enthusiast for hydroponics and aquaponics. I don't know if you have any interest in that.
Well, considering the fact that I own land that's in agriculture, no, hydroponics is my competitor.
Oh, it's your competitor. Okay. All right.
But, it's coming, and I don't think you'll be able to go into wheat, but things like tomatoes and vegetables and so on like that.
Not
yeah,
yet,
definitely.
Anyway. But it's interesting that you're into farming because aquaponics and aquaculture is another form of farming, which is a big area of interest of those who are interested in automated agriculture and aquaculture. There's a huge amount of interest in this.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a couple of ideas for my own little inventions that I'm working on, but there's still a little bit pie in the sky, and I've got to kind of figure out how to do them first.
A classic example is maybe we can comment on
it. Yeah, classic example is how do you get rid of weeds in a wheat field? Well,
there's a guy that published an article on the internet about a farming robot which plants the seed. This is not hydroponics and bears directly on your question. He built a farming robot, which is a sort of a Cartesian machine that plants seeds, and it knows where the plants are, and it does the weeding automatically.
Yeah, well, that's the kind of thing I twiddle with in my head. And it's not like my brother-in-laws aren't out there adding that last little bit of technology on top of the computers, because, you know, they got GPS that measures down to the inch, and they run as far as 2 miles in a straight line that is, you know, controlled within 1 inch.
Exactly.
Automatic turnaround, stuff like that.
This is an exact example of how these technologies are affecting farming and every aspect of industry. So, I mean, it's very pertinent to our discussion.
So that means they had 3D printing and all of this when they built the pyramids?
No, it's very interesting you should mention the pyramids, because there's a fellow whose name is Joseph Davidovits, who's actually, I meant to bring this up, he invented a new kind of concrete which has applications to those who are interested, people who want to do manufacturing with regolith. Joseph Davidovits invented a chemical process which is a new form of concrete which can be used in the production of regolith, and he did this by studying the pyramids. His claim is that the pyramids were made by a primitive form of concrete, limestone concrete. He has a very interesting website that describes his theories on this, and it's quite interesting.
Okay.
Well, I've had enough fun. I'll let somebody else call in and go with it.
Thank you very much, Marshall.
Okay, bye.
So, listeners, the line is available, 1-866-687-7223, and we're pretty much at the halfway point. You want to stop and pause and take a break and then regroup in a couple of minutes?
Sure, that sounds good.
Okay, so listeners, we're going to pause right now. Again, the number, if you want to call during the break or when we get off of break, 1-866-687-7223. And email, of course, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Don't go anywhere. Back in 3 minutes with Barry Levin.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Sunday program. Barry Levin is our guest. A couple of sponsors for this segment. AIAA is the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. They are the largest aerospace professional society in the world, with over 30,000 individual members, representing 88 countries and 95 corporate members. They shape the future of aerospace every day, advancing the state of aerospace science and technology and increasing our knowledge of the universe. So please check them out, AIAA.org. Also, Orbital ATK is a sponsor. They're known as a global leader in aerospace and defense technologies, and they are the partner you can count on for advanced, reliable space propulsion systems for space exploration, commercial ventures, and defense programs. And then Celestis is, of course, our sponsor. They are the premier space memorial service in the world, and their website, Celestis.com. And they are taking reservations now for the second Lunar Memorial spaceflight, where they will fly people's cremated remains, or your DNA, if you want to include your DNA, to the moon. Moon Express, one of the contestants for the Google Lunar X Prize, is going to host this Celestis lunar mission, and that's scheduled near the end of the year, this year. Last year, the U.S. government approved the Moon X mission for the moon. Just a few weeks ago, Moon Express announced it had secured funding for their flight, so all the ingredients are coming together for their second Celestis flight. The moon is a uniquely compelling location to remember a special life, and with the Celestis DNA service, you can fly your DNA there as well. Join families from around the world later this year at the Cape, and they also have a launch site in New Zealand for this ultimate mission of purpose. So again, check them out, Celestis.com. Barry Levin is with us. We're talking about the fourth industrial revolution, and caller John from Fort Worth is on the line. Hi, John. Welcome back to the show. How are you?
Oh, fine.
And what's on your mind today, please?
Well, your guest was mentioning earlier about the idea that basically there hasn't been a fundamental advance in rocketry, since the, well, basically it's pretty stagnant, really, which I agree with that. And I guess the question, though, is that comes up is that although we can do a lot of things with, There are areas where technology is advancing, such as the production technologies like 3D printing and all that stuff. There's genetics, that whole area, biotechnology, computer technology, electronics. But it looks to me like some areas, you just get into a plateau. I mean, and rocketry may be kind of reaching that.
This is my point, that rocketry is stuck in the age of heroic engineering. And my point is that the fourth industrial revolution has the capability of changing that and being a game changer in terms of bringing down the cost of access.
But I'm trying to see how. I mean, basically, it comes down to a basic issue of just making the rockets themselves, the actual vehicles, cheaper. Is that what you're suggesting, that we'd still be using the same kind of vehicles, but we could manufacture the actual
vehicles
cheaper?
That is my point. The room for advancement comes not in radical new technology, it comes in radical new manufacturing. Because if you take the cost of capital and labor, that's 99%. The actual steel and aluminum is less than 1% of the cost of the vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And fourth industrial technology can eliminate labor completely. So we theoretically, and of course, I'm exaggerating here to make a point. Nobody assume that we can make the vehicles for the cost of the steel. Eventually, 100 years from now, that'll be the case. But we can drive the cost down considerably by automating the process of manufacturing the vehicles. And there is an order of magnitude gain possible in the near term. Near term, I mean 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess SpaceX, has achieved a lot of improvement in cost due to the way they structure their production and the way they've actually do a lot of things in-house, and they produce large numbers of rocket engines, for instance, so that you have a much more efficient process of just making a few really big, powerful engines, I guess.
Yes, SpaceX is actually, you'd have to sort of call them a fourth industrial technology company. They use 3D printing extensively, and they use organizational principles, and they use 3D modeling software. So it's clear that they have at least the potential to change the game. Whether in the long run they'll be able to succeed, we'll see. But in general, my point being is that if the entire industrial infrastructure is improved, space costs will come down radically.
So it's that sort of improvement, not necessarily a fundamentally different type of vehicle, then.
No, the idea, and this is what I think is counterintuitive. In the space community, the belief is that it's new technology that will drive down the cost. And I think that it's new industrial manufacturing capability. And I think that there are two orders of magnitude that can be driven down. 99% of the cost of building space hardware is labor or organization or the capital needed to organize the labor and the and manufacturing facilities. The promise of these technologies is that they can automate a great deal of the production costs and radically drive down the cost. So my point is if we're really going to space as a spacefaring nation such that the industrial sector will have a much wider access to space, we're going via the fourth industrial revolution. That's how we're going to get there.
Oh, okay. That clarifies, I guess, the point you were making. I just was trying to understand that because I was thinking that, you know, basically there are a lot of areas where you simply run into laws of physics plateaus, you know, that things get improved incrementally after a while, but basically, you know, you're there. I mean, you can look at the evolution of a lot of things that kind of end up that way, you know.
Yes, but the thing that's not intuitive is that we don't need new physics, we don't need new materials, we need new manufacturing techniques, which are about to come to hand. And the other aspect of this is that people who are interested can experiment, because the one of the remarkable features of the fourth industrial revolution is that the technology scales. The same machine which is used by SpaceX to produce their Draco thrusters, they're using a super high-tech 3D printer, which probably costs $1 million or $2 million. But the basic ideas involved in that can be done by you in your house using a $200 printer. You can't make Draco thrusters because you're printing in plastic and they're printing in stainless steel or titanium, but you could print a model of it which is exactly the same, and you could get the knowledge that's involved in making these things at super low cost. This is something that's critical to explain, that the radical aspect of the fourth industrial technologies is that they scale all the way from Elon Musk at SpaceX, which is the super high end, and it scales all the way down to kindergarten, where people are using simple, really low-cost 3D printers, and they're printing out crayons. But SpaceX is printing out Draco space thrusters, and children in kindergarten are printing out crayons. The principle is the same.
I see what you're saying there, yeah.
And the possibility, all these kids who are in kindergarten now learning how to do this, these are the entrepreneurs of the future. They'll know how to use these technologies to create new businesses and create new jobs. I'm not saying that it's a panacea. We have a problem. The growth of industrial technologies is destabilizing our social institutions. It's destabilizing our economy. I'm not trying to say that these new technologies are a panacea, but what I'm trying to say is there's hope in that direction, that people who are interested in picking up the gauntlet of learning these skills can make careers, can make entrepreneurial opportunities for themselves, and the cost of entry is very, very low.
Yeah, the cost you're talking about, I can see your point. Well, thanks. So, I think you've cleared up what I was asking about.
Oh, thanks, John.
Okay. Appreciate your call, John.
I'll clear the line. Let somebody else get in.
Thank you.
Okay.
So, listeners, if you want to call us again, it is 1-866-687-7223. And email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. You know, if any of you out there have a consumer or desktop printer and you use it in your business or for fun or to teach your kids, we'd love to hear from you. So
also, one of the things I wanted to suggest is if anybody has an area of interest or, you know, they're interested in entrepreneurship, they can call up and say, I'm interested in this, and, you know, what technologies can I look into to help push my idea forward. There are some people I know are interested in manufacturing habs on the moon and Mars using regolith. That's one possible area of interest. But anything is fair game. If you're some listener to the show and you want to throw out your idea to see if it has any relevance to these technologies, please call in and we'll see if we can come up with something.
Since we're basically talking about a chemical rocket, because we're not talking about nuclear or any other kind of rocket for all practical purposes. What fuel can be made for the rocket using a consumer type of 3D printer?
You know, I don't think you're making rocket fuel, but there's an analog. There's bioreactors, algae, and you can actually make rocket fuel from algae. They're making jet fuel. They're making RP-1. They're actually making rocket fuel from algae, and you could do this in your house. That this is really interesting. And I put there's a link on the in the document that I put on the website. There's a link there to algae bioreactor, and you could actually make rocket fuel in your house by making a bioreactor, growing algae, and learning the processes of chemical separation, how to separate the oil fragment from the biological fragment. So the answer to your question is yes, you could actually make rocket fuel in your house.
That ought to be real safe and sane, right?
Well, you know, I mean, we're not talking about making 1,000 gallons at once. We're talking about if you had let's say you had a 50-gallon bioreactor, you know, maybe you could make a gallon of fuel a month.
Okay, so that's not very much.
So we're not talking about, but I mean, if you were seriously interested in producing your own fuel, you know, you could get a kiddie swimming pool and make 500 gallons at a time.
And that would be fun. Wait till the city finds out what you're doing.
Yeah, wait till the city finds out. But you know, the interesting thing about that is if you in the beginning, if let's say you were some high school student and you wanted to have a science fair project on making biofuels, you could do the bioreactor and you could demonstrate all the chemical principles. It would be a great science fair project.
Are more and more kids doing science fair projects with 3D printers?
Absolutely.
So that's getting to be commonplace?
It's getting to be common, yes. That's a great – this is something that is not fully brought out in terms of the importance of 3D printing, because 3D printing is only a small part of the fourth industrial revolution technologies. If you combine 3D printing with optics and biology, – you get a tremendous synergy, because there seems to be a little bit of a confusion. Well, you know, what is 3D printing good for? All you can print out is plastic parts. Well, as an example, I just finished building a 3D biological microscope, and I used some lenses and some cheap CMOS cameras, and I printed the housing that holds all the parts. This is a fundamental thing to understand. This is really important for people to understand. The value of a thing like a 3D printer is it takes the labor out of assembling an entire instrument. I use lenses to focus the light from an LED onto a biological sample, and those lenses are used to focus the image on a low-cost CMOS camera, which is available for $20. And the power of the 3D printing is that you can make very complicated housings for optical instruments or environmental sensing instruments, and the labor involved in making those housings is tremendous. If you use a 3D printer, the labor goes into the design, and then you press the button, you stick the lenses in, you stick the camera in, and you have a completed object. I cannot stress how revolutionary this is. You can make entire products in a single shot by incorporating electronics, optics, and using the 3D printer to assemble all the components into an easily a labor-free manufacturing process. This is incredibly radical. It is manufacturing and design without labor. And we are not talking about pie in the sky here. We are talking about things that I am doing on a daily basis, and that listeners to this show could do should they become interested enough in to put the energy into it.
Sarah sent in an email in Seattle, and she said, you mentioned job displacement in the first part of the show. I've also been reading where the Silicon Valley billionaires are all leaving or buying residences or land or something in New Zealand, and they say part of the reason is because of unsettling in the world due to job and labor displacement due to technology. So obviously the people causing the disruption realize what they're causing, and their answer is possibly to have a place to retreat and flee. None of us will have that option. So how do you combat this type of unsettledness that even the people perpetrating the unsettledness are causing for us?
This is a fantastic question from Sarah, and I have an answer. The answer is involvement. And, you know, this is the most problematic aspect of what I'm suggesting, because there's work involved here. But that's on the dark side. The good side is if you do the work, there's a solution to the problem. That's right. None of it. We're not fleeing. I'm not fleeing to New Zealand. I'm not fleeing to, and you're not fleeing. What we can do is put our brains together and educate ourselves and use the same technologies that are causing the disruption to fix the disruption. And I think that we can do it. I think that there's so much opportunity in terms of things that all the things that I put on the blog for this show. All the devices can be built by people with a high school education. If we have a grassroots movement to educate people in using these technologies, we can create a new kind of economy. I realize that sounds far-fetched, but it's not. And I don't mean to imply that everyone will become an entrepreneur, because everyone is not an entrepreneur. But one entrepreneur, most of the jobs are created by small businesses. If you have people listening to the show that pick up the challenge of learning these tools, and by the way, let's say you're somebody listening to the show and you're looking at all this stuff and saying, well, I'm not a technologist, I can't learn this. You don't have to be a technologist. You just have to learn, you just have to gain the vocabulary, and you can hire somebody like me who is a technologist, or somebody on your block who is a technologist. Considering there are hundreds of thousands of graduate-level engineers and technologists in this country, there's an engineer on every block in the United States. So you don't personally have to develop the technology, but let's say you're somebody that wants to build, oh, I don't know, a knitting machine. I'll go to some completely opposite direction, because Jerry pointed out that, you know, the space economy is not a big part of the economy. Let's say you're somebody who's interested in textiles. 3D printing is now producing circular knitting machines. You could find someone to collaborate with if you have a market for these things, and you could be an entrepreneur, or you could be a salesperson. There's lots of ways to be involved in this technology without having to build it yourself. I haven't meant to imply that you need to. I like building this stuff myself, but not everybody is like that. But that doesn't mean that you can't participate. You can find out what the technology is all about, and you can find out applications. You can learn a small little niche. You can learn some small little part of it and gain a foothold into the new economy. Jobs are going to be displaced, not necessarily entirely removed.
Well, Barry, realistically, can this happen and spread and develop at such a rate that Peter Thiel and others will sell their New Zealand properties and not consider going down there?
Yes.
You really think so?
Yes, I do.
So I know grass is legal in California. I didn't think it started.
No, I don't. I don't. That's it. That's actually part of the. That's actually part of the hydroponics economy. It's a big part of the hydroponics.
What, growing marijuana?
Yes. I've been approached by people who want to build units.
Well, I guess it's legal now in California, right?
It is. I mean, I'm not interested in that, so I don't do it. But I've been approached by two separate
individuals. Well, I was just joking, because I'm too skeptical to think that this could happen at a rate significant enough to have the billionaires sell their New Zealand land and not be worried about this.
You know, I don't take that too seriously. If there's worldwide disruption, where are you going to go?
New Zealand, obviously, right?
No, but I mean, that's not a real solution for the general problem. You know, and the point is, you know, people have a right to be skeptical. Is this really, you know, a solution? And the problem is that it takes effort and it takes education. But here's the thing. Do you, it's an investment in yourself. People have no problem investing several thousand dollars in a vacation. Why not invest a few hundred dollars and investigate if these new technologies are applicable to the things that you're interested in? I happen to be interested in optics. I'm interested in environmental sensing. I'm interested in medical instrumentation. Other people have different interests. These technologies are extraordinarily broad in their application. No matter what your interest is, there's some aspect of this technology that you can use to increase your economic fitness.
Okay, so let's roll up our sleeves here and get real for a minute. When Joan and Rich were on the show Tuesday, they got a question about how you do 3D printing and stuff. So the first thing they start talking about is you create a file, and we got them to tell us that the file is in STL or
STL
or something. So first of all, who the hell knows what STL is? Who the hell knows how to program in it? You know, most of us can't even work 5% of the features on our iPhone or our Android phone or Word or Excel. And so what, we're supposed to learn how to program in something like this or in a CAD programs?
David, it's an excellent question, okay.
Including me, by the way. I could no more do that or a CAD program, Barry, than I could flap my wings and launch myself to the moon. Even if I lost 30 pounds, I
could. You could do it, and I'll explain. We actually might
You want to come tutor me as an on the job lesson to show how one could actually learn this on the space show? I'll volunteer.
I think it's the thing I'm exploring, being able to broadcast a lesson from my home. We might try at some future show to do an actual lesson for people who are interested in learning the technology. I was thinking about that.
Well, you couldn't get a more of a dunce of a contestant than me to try to get you to do it.
You've raised the key issue here, and this is called the learning curve. This is the fundamental problem. People who do not have the technological vocabulary, they look at the stuff and they say, it's all Greek to me. And this is the problem that has to be overcome. Because let's say I were to tell you that if you spent even if you know nothing, let's say you know zero. Even if you know nothing, I would say that it would take you 100 hours to become proficient enough at 3D modeling to do useful things. Now, people say, 100 hours? That's a big investment. And it is a big investment. But these technologies are powerful, and there's no power without investment. If people are looking, the question you ask is really fundamental. If people are looking for a solution to the problem of technological unemployment that costs nothing, it doesn't exist. The cost is the energy that you have to put into learning the technologies. It's the learning curve. Because when you learn these new technologies, for the first 10 or 20 hours, you're saying to yourself, this is all Greek to me. I don't understand any of this. I'll never learn it. That's the initial reaction that everyone has. And you have to put in 25 to 50 hours just to become literate in what you don't know. Once you put in that 25 to 50 hours, a whole new world opens up.
Does that mean I'll get ideas of what I can print and sell, for example, or what I can do that I can't even conceive of today?
Yes. With an investment of 25 to 50 hours, I could make you proficient. Proficient enough to understand what it would... Let's say you had some interest in building... I'm just taking this off the top of my head.
Okay.
Let's say you had some bit interest in building... Since you're a space enthusiast like myself, let's say you wanted to build some sort of a semi-working model of a spacecraft. I could teach you enough about 3D printing in 25 to 50 hours that you would understand the nature of the problem. You could download models from the Internet. You could download them into your 3D printer. You could print out the parts and start assembling your own models. Access to this technology is not free. It requires an input of time. And for those who are looking for a solution that requires no effort, no money, that doesn't exist. We have serious social problems brought about by technological innovation. The solutions are going to require effort. But I put to you that if people put in the effort, they can vastly improve their economic fitness they can make themselves employable, or they can give themselves entrepreneurial opportunities, or they can gain access to expertise that they need to move their businesses forward. There are numerous paths forward, and if you're someone that doesn't really want to learn the nuts and bolts of the technology, that doesn't mean you can't use the technology. There are plenty of people like me around, and Rich and the Horvath, who had the excellent 3D printing show. You can access their expertise. You can hire them, and that's an aspect of the new economy. You yourself don't have to be an expert, but you can get access to an expert, and you can find out how that their expertise can be applied to your particular problem. There are numerous ways to move forward. The situation is not hopeless. It's really not.
Of course, we don't ever hear of any retraining job skills along these lines, do we?
No, but the retraining, to a certain extent, that's a government programs for retraining are not the answer. Self-motivation is the answer, because as I pointed out, the access to these technologies does not take much money. You can build a 3D printer. My kit was an excellent kit. For $300, I have a super high-quality 3D printer. I can print whatever I want. In terms of its limitations, I can't print steel, I can't print metals, but as your 3D printing show pointed out, you can make molds, and if you want to, you can cast in metal. So you can use lost wax techniques with PLA. So there's no limit except for the amount of energy you're willing to put in. And I think if we were to do a future show, we should consider the possible topic of how people could acquire the knowledge to use these technologies and apply it to their business interests or their job-seeking interests. Because if a young person or even an elderly person who's interested in finding employment in the workplace, knowledge of 3D printing and 3D modeling is an excellent investment in time, because if you master these technologies, you will find work.
You've got another email question from Tim, who is in Huntsville. And he says, technically, moonshiners have been brewing some potent stuff that can be used as rocket fuel for about a century. But all kidding aside, alcohol is a liquid hydrocarbon and could be used as a rocket fuel.
It can. I mean, you can brew this. I mean, actually, brewing and distilling is another area where it's sort of an extension of hydroponics. It involves various different bacteriological or yeast cultures, and there's a huge enthusiast community that are pioneering fermentation, brewing of beer, brewing of alcohol, making of yogurts and kefirs and various types of kombucha and various types. So, I mean, yes, what Tim points out, there's an opportunity to do really meaningful work in that area.
Interesting. You mentioned earlier, and in fact several times during the show, that in terms of moving space forward, it's more than 3D printing. So what are the top fourth industrial revolution technologies that are most applicable to space?
There's optics, which is a big, you know, that's sensing. In other words, there's not just optics, there's sensor technology. This is key. I'm going to use another buzzword here called the Internet of Things, which is, you know, that's the latest craze in Internet technologies. That means the connection of various types of sensor devices in a vast worldwide network where all things are connected to each other. And this is a very important thing, sensors. This amplifies the value of 3D printing. I'm using optical sensors in my work. I am building what's called a turbidimeter, which is measuring water quality by measuring the scattering of light. I pass a laser beam through a sample, and then I measure how much light is scattered. The amount of light scattered by the laser beam is a measure of how pure the water is. The purer the water is, the less light is scattered. And there are various types of sensors, optical sensors, that can measure this. So the 3D printing becomes basically a way of assembling the sensors and the electronics so you can make, so the 3D printing becomes vastly more powerful when it's mated to sensor technology and small, cheap computers. A few examples of the small, cheap computer are the Arduino and the Raspberry Pi. I have links to those on my document that I posted on the blog. The Raspberry Pi is a $35 computer, which is a full computer about the size of a deck of cards, and it has ports in it that you can attach sensors to, so you can measure various industrial processes, and based on the response to those processes, you can control motors to accomplish various actions. So there's the Raspberry. Actually, there's a new version of the Raspberry Pi, which instead of costing $35, costs $5. So the cost of this stuff is essentially zero compared to the amount of energy and labor. The labor is in learning the technology, and the learning curve there is a little bit steep. I'm not saying that these things are easy to learn, but I would say that these technologies, microprocessor programming, 3D printing, mechanical, motor control, sensor, these courses should be in every high school in the United States, and even in middle schools,
yeah,
because there are much simpler versions of this. There are temperature sensors and light sensors that cost 50 cents a piece. You could do this in middle school.
But for adults that are laid off of work or out of work, they're not going back to high school or middle school. So.
But they could. I mean, maybe they have. Let's say you're a laid off worker, but you've been working for 20 or 30 years. You have exposure to various environments. You could be asking yourself, what part of the environment that I worked in my life, what experience can I use and couple it to some aspect of these new technologies to make myself more employable again? All the technologies that I listed on the blog post, these are a vast amount of technologies. I just put this out as a sort of a smorgasbord to give people an idea of what are the different technologies. All you have to do is learn one of these technologies. You don't have to learn 20. So the answer is yes. It is possible to retrain people, even though that approach has not been successful in the past, because I think the new approach would, instead of charging thousands of dollars to retrain individuals, buy them a 3D printer for $300 and give them, you know, and give them access to lectures that could be produced online, so you could produce one lecture, one educational lecture, and it could be available to a million people. So there are solutions. It's not pain-free. Education is somewhat difficult. It requires effort. To me, I think that the barrier is teaching people that the educational process is joyous and fun. It's not something you have to grit your teeth and say, oh, God, I have to learn this. This is awful. It's a wonderful thing. You can apply these technologies to any interest you have. Let's say you're interested in boat making or fishing or something like that. You can make model boats. These technologies can be applied to anything. So I guess in terms of retraining, if you can show people how these technologies are applied to the things that they're really interested in, I think that we can amplify the educational process greatly. This is not a hopeless case. It will require a readjustment of the way people approach the problem, but it's doable. I don't think we're going to resort to social chaos. There are solutions, and we can act. The people who are listeners to the show that have an interest in this kind of thing, we can help spread the word and participate in the solution. I'm hoping to create a little enthusiasm for starting to solve the problem. We know that the problem is coming, and I'm suggesting that by finding ways, we can do experiments in learning to see, you know, what are the best methods of teaching people these things. We could actually do, the listeners to the show could actually do meaningful research by exploring, since people do not know these technologies, we could do some experiments in how best that people could acquire these skills.
So you have another email from Linda in Chicago. And Linda says, Barry, I've heard all of your calls and programs to the Space Show on this topic. I don't know if David and you plan on doing another back of the envelope program, but I really think it's time to stop all the talk. So if you do come back for another program, you need to find a way to illustrate or demonstrate or put into action what it is you're talking about. You need to get away from just talking about it to doing.
That's a great suggestion. I agree with that.
I don't know, Linda, how to do that, but maybe Barry has some solid ideas on how to do that, or maybe some of you listening either live or on archives might have some ideas of how to do that. And, you know, we could try something like that.
I think Linda's got a great idea. I think that's right. I think the time to stop is to stop talking about it and actually come up with a way to actually start spreading the knowledge and providing a platform that we can use to educate people. I think that's the right.
And maybe we could do it through a webinar or something. I don't know.
Maybe we could.
But I'll let you figure it out, Barry.
Okay. I'll work on that. But thanks for the suggestion, Lynn. That's great.
Barry, I know you've spoken that, and you've said government policy, like for retraining and stuff like that, isn't going to work. Why can't there be some kind of a government program or a project model on the lines of what you're talking about that might reach some people and might be beneficial?
There could. I was too hasty in dismissing that. But I like to think of working from the entrepreneurial end. You know, maybe there could be businesses, retraining businesses. You know, I'm sort of oriented toward entrepreneurial solutions as opposed to government solutions. But you're right, there could be government programs.
I know there are a lot of small business and entrepreneurial workshops, you know, with the Chamber and SBA and other things like that. But I haven't checked them in recent years, but my hunch is none of them go down into the world that you're talking about.
But, you know, there's an intermediary solution. There are things called maker spaces. I don't know if you're aware of this.
Or maker fair. I'm familiar with them. Never been to one.
So that's a partial solution. If people want access to this information, there are maker spaces in every county in the United States. They can go down, and there are people who are participating in these ideas, and they can get hands-on experience at no cost. Join up with these maker spaces. I mean, sometimes there's a small cost, like maybe $30 or $40 per month, but you get access to the expertise, you get access to the equipment, you can actually start experimenting. So, yes.
Do you have a service, or do you help people, or do you make recommendations on consumer printers to purchase if someone doesn't want to build their Heathkit version of a printer?
I could, you know, I haven't wanted to do that on the air. I'm not affiliated with any companies. I know what the good products are.
So
I don't know if you want to do a show on that or something. You know, what are the products that people? I mean, I guess Linda's suggestion is, you know, we ought to, if we do another show on this, we ought to teach people how to get involved. I think she's right on the mark.
I'm not really that interested in recommending or promoting different products. So first of all, I don't want to be responsible for someone buying
exactly
something.
Exactly. I mean, it's problematic.
And being pedo, and they're not sponsoring us. And so,
exactly.
As Joan and Rich said, there's a lot of products between $500 and $2,000 or so on the market.
That's right.
But so if somebody wants to engage a consultant to find that out, I suppose those consultants are available.
The information is readily available on YouTube. I should post this on the website, but there's a gentleman whose name is Thomas Sadler, who's a super expert, and he's reviewed every major 3D printing product that exists.
Really?
He's a super good expert, and he's very, very knowledgeable, and anybody that wants to know the pluses and the minuses of any given 3D product can go to Thomas Sadler's website, and he's reviewed every single 3D product on the market.
Interesting.
So the information can be had for free.
Where do you see all of this going in the next two or three years?
Well, I see. From my standpoint, I'm in the entrepreneurial space. I'm thinking of starting businesses based on these technologies. But in terms of where it's going for the culture, I think people have seen that there's a problem with technological unemployment, and I think that people will start to ask, you know, what should we do? Like Linda has asked, you know, what should we do? Let's do something. And there's a lot you can do. People can begin experimenting. The first thing you can do is just educate yourself. Look at some of the things that I've posted and start, just gain a vocabulary. You don't have to worry in the beginning about learning so much how to use these technologies, but just acquaint yourself with the different areas, and then you can say, oh, well, that's interesting to me, and then you can pursue it further. The first step is just to become cognizant of what it is, what kinds of tools are involved, what kinds of potentials exist. And then the next question is, you know, how can I use this to improve my employability? And, Linda has made the suggestion that we do some demonstrations. I don't know to what extent you're interested in doing that, or what extent the listener, I don't know if the listeners are actually interested in that, but we'll have to find out and see if anybody posts comments at the shows.
Yeah, I'd be interested. Here, you have another email from a person named Cleve. So it says, the guest has opened up the ugly truth about what is wrong with this country and is exemplified by the attitude of all those unemployed masses that want to go back to 1956. What all the cavemen that have put us into this position is... Wait a minute. What all the cavemen that have put us into this position is the idiotic attitude, I can't learn this, it's too hard. I just want to go out in my pickup truck and go drinking and play basketball and footsie ball with my other dummy buddies. Of course, I think that's an exaggeration, but he is making a point. If you don't learn reading, math, science, and coding in 2017, then please crawl back into the holes you squirmed out of and give the rest of elite humanity a chance to grow and have a brighter future. Go learn something useful. And the problem, Cleve, with your description of humanity, which may be correct, I'm not here to argue with you or to turn this into a political show, is that those people that are crawling back in, as you have suggested, they are, you know, being supported by social services that everybody pays for. And if you read the news, there are trends in certain European countries and certain cities in America to give people a universal income in addition to whatever they may be getting from disability or Social Security or something like that. I know the city of Oakland is considering a trial with something like that, and other cities in the United States have said they're considering that, and European cities are considering that. So to the degree that you shun people and put them back into a cave or however you're describing it, they're not going to be put back into the cave without some kind of support that you and others working are going to pay for through our taxes. So it's beneficial to get people to be productive rather than to not be productive, in my opinion. And I personally don't think, you know, name-calling is a way you get people productive, though I might absolutely, in a private conversation with you, agree 100% with your descriptors. But anyway, Barry, your comments.
Yeah, I agree with your comments that, you know, there's no point in... I agree with some of Cleve's ideas, not... I don't agree with, you know, denigrating people, but he's got a point that we have a problem in this country that people don't want to invest the time in learning, and that's going to handicap them when it comes to the future. And I guess our challenge here is to find ways to make the learning process accessible. And I'd like to challenge Linda to write in the comments in the blog to tell us the kinds of things that she's interested in learning, because maybe I can come up with something so that we can actually make some sort of step in the right direction to answer Cleve's objection and Linda's objection, how can we make these technologies available to the ordinary person, and how can we motivate people to become interested in their own futures, which I think is the thing that you addressed in your comments.
Right, and you know, this is a space show, so most of the listeners to the space show are, even if they don't have the skills, are interested in advanced technologies and math and engineering and physics and things of that nature. So you're talking to an audience here that is not the typical American audience by any means, and I think that's important.
That's why this is a good starting point, because people who are listeners to this show, should they decide to become involved in this process, can be ambassadors and can start asking the questions that both Cleve in a way and Linda in her own way, they're asking, well, okay, you know, this is talk, you know, how can we actually do something to help people learn this? And, you know, both Cleve and Linda have offered suggestions that point in the same direction. People do not have access to the educational process such that they can learn these. I could ask myself a question, and we could ask ourselves the question on this show, what could we actually do to help the problem? And I think that, you know, I like Linda's challenge. I like it. You know, what could we actually do to help the problem? And I think there are things we can do. I'll think about it. You know, how could we have some kind of a show that actually teaches people and demonstrates the technology in action and actually shows the mechanical engineering aspects of the problem, the software aspects of the problem? We could. I think there's some way we could approach this problem.
You have another caller. So, hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you and where are you? Hello, caller. They didn't hang up because I don't have a dial tone. Hello, caller, are you there? Going once, twice, okay. Well, whoever that caller is, their phone didn't connect. You can call us back, caller, and that is 1-866-687-7223, and stay with your phone so when we pick it up, we can talk to you. Because we'd like to hear from you before the show ends today. And here the phone's ringing again. Maybe this is our mysterious caller. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you? Hello?
Hello?
All I'm hearing is the feedback of my voice. So somebody's got a really crappy phone that they're trying to use. Caller, we can't understand or hear a word you're saying. So listeners, number one, turn off your computer. If you're trying to call and you've also got your computer speakers on, you got to disable that before you call the show. That's number one. And number two, you got to use a decent phone line, which I talk about to the nth degree every year, every show. So you can't call on a crappy consumer VoIP digital goofball phone line like Magic Jack or whatever you may be using. But turn off your computer speakers because that will throw off your call. And again, we'd like to hear from you if you can manage the technology. 1-866-687-7223. Maybe we can get them to develop a new kind of phone line technology, Barry. Okay, we're going to try again and see if we can pick up this caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Can you hear us, please?
Yeah, can you hear me now, David?
Yeah, who is this?
This is John in Fremont.
Boy, you know better, John.
Sorry, man.
So, God. Okay, John, go for it in your speed trap capital of California.
Yeah, you know, this is just a standard iPhone, and I don't know what the issue is. But anyway, hi, Barry.
Hi, John. How are you? Nice to hear from you.
Yeah, I left a blog post on your last show regarding some of the other technologies that would be needed to be developed. For instance, if we wanted to do 3D printing on the moon or that sort of thing, how close are we to, you know, some of the robotic type technologies that would be needed to refine lunar regolith into feedstock for 3D printing? And that's the first part of my question. And then the second part is, how far away do you think we are from von Neumann machines where, you know, we could self-replicate a 3D printer?
Well, there's two parts. There's the regolith and then there's the von Neumann machines. The regolith question is interesting because that was raised on the Horvath show by somebody. And the answer is that it's actually, I don't know how much research NASA is putting into it. There is some research. People have investigated Martian, you know, the Martian soils and lunar soils. But here's a more interesting thing. It's possible to experiment with this yourself because there's a very large interest in 3D printing in concrete to build structures here on Earth, and there's also a large interest in inflatable structures. So you could actually, at reasonable cost, do, if you wanted to investigate this, you could research it yourself. You could build a 3D printer, a small 3D printer, and start doing materials experimentation by trying to emulate the regolith by various means. Clays are available, different types of fillers are available. So the point is, and the point that I'm really making is that one of the radical aspects of the fourth industrial revolution is that it makes experimentation on even the highest levels available to people in their own garages. If you were interested enough in this, you could actually do the experiment yourself. In terms of von Neumann machines, that's a more controversial idea. There are actually the home 3D printing and the whole RepRap movement is about 3D machines printing themselves. And you can, if you have a single 3D printer, you can actually print out the parts for a second 3D machine. So the beginnings of your question could be answered by yourself. How far away are we from machines that can reproduce themselves? My guesstimate would be maybe no sooner than 25 years.
Okay, Hello? Well, wow. That's a great subject. But
you could do some primitive experimentation in this area yourself if you wanted to put in the time. The money is not that much.
John, do you have a printer?
No, I don't. And my company actually is heavily into this. And, we have a different product that we produce. So, I don't have time to do it myself. I think when I retire, it would be something I'd like to experiment with. But that's maybe 10 years down the road. And, it's an interesting topic.
Guys, let me call your attention to the show tomorrow with Dr. Phil Metzger. So I'm not sure if either of you are familiar with his work. But Phil is an ISRU, former NASA guy, now teaches these classes at Central Florida State. And using advanced technology and manufacturing here on Earth to develop space. So he's written many, many papers on the subject. He used to be with NASA, which is where I first met him, and where he was first on the show. And he was sort of their go-to guy on robotics. This was many years ago. And he's far more evolved from that. So he did send me some of his published papers on these topics that I'm going to see if I can get permission to put onto the blog, at least the URLs onto the blog, because they're on the web. But you both, and maybe the listening audience, if you're interested in this topic, you will want to listen to what Phil has to say. And you can Google him and get more information than I've got in my bio of him on the website. He's on the upcoming show menu for tomorrow, METZGER. It's going to be a continuation from a different perspective of the topics that we're talking about today. He's not talking about consumer stuff and laid off employees, but he is talking about advanced technologies and manufacturing and these subjects for space development and ISRU development.
Yeah,
hey John, I'm just curious. What is your company? What is your company using 3D printing to do? I'm just curious.
We are using 3D printing to print mold for clear aligners for straightening teeth.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Can you repeat that, John?
Invisalign, have you heard of that?
Oh, yes, I know it well.
Yeah, okay. For braces.
Braces, yeah, it's dental. I have clients who are dentists who use this stuff.
Yeah, so we have extensive manufacturing facilities, all robotics. And it's a big field, and we're on the cutting edge of that whole technology.
Do you do other dental stuff like crown printing and that kind of thing?
No, we don't. We're just in the straightening of teeth at this point, but we're looking at that.
I wonder if they print implants out of titanium. I mean, that would be a special printer, but that's usually what they're made from, as I understand it. Take a mold of the person's mouth or the tooth that they're removing and print implants to be exactly the same. I don't know if that's a possibility or not.
I would assume it could be done, yeah.
Yeah, so David, I've been looking forward to Phil Metzger's program, and I did see his paper on bootstrapping the solar system. So,
yeah, he gave me two papers. So I have to go back to his emails in December for the first paper, and then he just sent me one a week ago that he said was additional paper on a similar topic. So I want to put those URLs up on the blog. So I'll see if I can get them done maybe after the Super Bowl today, because I'm supposed to go to a Super Bowl party. But we will see. But hopefully you can listen live and call in and talk to him. You'll probably be at work, but maybe you can still do it.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
Hey, great show, guys. Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John.
Listeners, we're approaching 2 hours, so if you do want to get a call in to Barry, now is the time to do it. Don't hesitate. 1-866-687-7223. So a von Neumann probe is a machine that can repeat itself. Is that what you're talking about? Barry, are you there? Hello.
Sending humans out, you send out machines, and they colonize planets. They use the local materials, and they build copies of themselves and spread throughout the galaxy automatically.
So this is named after... John von Neumann,
the mathematician scientist.
Behind the computer in the Philadelphia experiment.
Von Neumann, I don't know about the Philadelphia experiment.
Yeah, I think he's the same von Neumann. I mean, it's just, unless I'm getting the names, similar names confused.
Well, von Neumann was a pioneer in the whole idea of computers and what it would take for programs to reproduce themselves, and considered to be one of the geniuses of the 20th century.
Bijan is in Sweden, and he may be what ends up being our last question of the day for you. We'll see. He says you call it a fourth industrial revolution as if it happens during a limited period, but do you see any end to it? Won't technologies be developed continuously forever after a similar rate we experience today?
Well, I mean, the issue and the reason, it's a good question. The issue is that the growth of technology this is a key point. The growth of technology is becoming exponential. And human beings are not good at understanding exponential growth rates. This is a major problem. And Moore's Law started this with the fabrication of integrated circuits, such that the power of computers per dollar doubles every 18 months. That's exponential growth. We're now entering a phase where these technologies are promising to do the same thing for the physical world that Moore's Law did for the world of information. And not only will, as the emailer mentioned, won't technology improve at a continuing rate? The point is that it'll improve at an exponential rate,
And there are people who call themselves singularitarians who believe that sometime around 2040, when artificial intelligence becomes sentient or equal in power to human intelligence, that there will be sort of a singularity, a point beyond which all history becomes unpredictable, because the growth of technology will then become maybe double every day. When machines can improve themselves at the rate of computational processes, at that point it's impossible for human beings to understand how fast technology can improve. So, I mean, these are crises. Human beings are not exponential creatures. For most of our evolutionary history, things didn't change that much. It's only been in the time of the last three industrial revolutions, beginning with steam, which was the first industrial revolution, electricity, the second industrial revolution, computers, the third industrial revolution, and now artificial intelligence, the internet, and ubiquitous computing and connectedness, the fourth industrial revolution. The pace of change is becoming increasing rapidly. So yes, there will be, and this is the social problem. And, I'm glad, this is a good place to start a conversation, because as people have pointed out, there are big problems. And as David has pointed out, the technologists, our Silicon Valley people are buying refuges in New Zealand because they see a deluge coming. My approach to that is to try to build up some social cohesion and to build up some communities of people who are trying to solve the problem. And I think the problem can be solved.
The people I know that are by far and away not billionaires or millionaires also see the problem coming, and they're buying guns and ammo. So maybe
I know there are a lot of
wealthy
are doing that. That's not my approach. I don't want to live in a future where I have to fight off the neighbors.
Maybe the wealthy are more advanced. I don't know,
they have drones.
They have drones. Yeah. Well, anyone talk about all these industrial advantages, anyone can have a drone now. What does it cost to buy a drone from Amazon? So practically
not much.
And most people could learn how to work it. They certainly don't seem to be any technological barriers to numbskulls flying them into
airplanes. I have customers that are using drones to advertise their businesses.
Yeah. Here's another email, which is probably going to be the last because we're almost at the two-hour point. This is Adrian in San Diego. And he says the idea that that a governmental university salary is to be provided to those unemployed or displaced. So, first of all, Adrian, a correction. The articles I'm talking about are that everybody gets a universal salary. Even Elon Musk would get a universal salary. Even Donald Trump would get a universal salary. It has nothing to do with unemployed or being displaced from jobs in the articles that I've talked about. Okay, now I will go back to your email, given that I may have corrected a misperception based on what I said earlier. The idea that a governmental universal salary is to be provided to those unemployed or displaced from jobs by technology is not a bad idea. This, however, should be coupled to an educational requirement. Even without a government stipend, individuals with self-motivation can always access a local public library to find related books, and in many cases, they also provide how-to workshops in using 3D printers, Strawberry Pi, and Arduino programming. These are small microprocessors, some costing less than $20. There is no excuse for a lack of education unless the individual is mentally challenged or disturbed, and these individuals should be provided institutions to care for them. So I can think of a lot of reasons.
I really agree with the sentiments behind that. Here's the thing that I think, that we need to change some of the cultural values. I think it's the responsibility of every person who's a citizen of an advanced country to educate themselves to whatever extent they can. I mean, that's not considered to be, at this point in our cultural development, that's not considered to be a requirement. I'm not saying it should be a law. I'm not saying there should be any government involvement in this, but there needs to be a social change. What's coming in the future requires a population that has more education than we do now. And I think that perhaps, you know, based on the suggestion of Linda and Cleve, perhaps we could, you know, make a move in that direction. How can we foster dissemination of information and education about these technologies? How can we help people acquire these skills? I think that's a very interesting and progressive question.
Well, I know that jobs programs that have tried to force people to go to jobs interviews or to get retraining and all that don't typically work. So,
no, I'm with you. I'm with you, Dave.
Okay, last email, listeners, because I've got an appointment, and so we have a hard break coming up at the two-hour point. And if you want more of Barry, post it on the blog and tell Barry and me that you want more of him. This is from Bijan again in Sweden. Have you heard of Sir Roger Penrose's thoughts on how intelligence is not computational and never can be emulated by computer? Do you believe in AI and a technological singularity, which you mentioned a few minutes ago?
I'm well aware of Roger Penrose's ideas about consciousness. He's in a minority. He believes that consciousness is completely unique to the biological underpinnings. Most people don't agree with that. And, you know, the question of the status of artificial intelligence is very complex, and I can't answer the question in 2 minutes. But artificial intelligence is already advanced enough to be causing major upheavals, and it will certainly get better. Whether artificial intelligence will ever become sentient or ever be a mirror of human intelligence, I don't know. But it's very clear to me that artificial intelligence will become powerful enough to change the fundamental way society is arranged.
Barry, any closing comments, any pearls of wisdom until the next time we convene?
I'd like people to, log into the blog, Linda and others who feel the way she does, and make suggestions as to how we can fulfill their needs in the future. You know, I like Linda's suggestion that we develop some kind of a show to involve interactive. I think that's very important. Can we develop some kind of a platform so that people can call in, I can demonstrate the software, I can give lessons, I can show my 3D printer printing something? You know, that's something that I would have to work on. But if people are interested, I'll do it.
Okay, and listeners, we would really like your feedback on that. So let us know your suggestions and ideas on the blog. Barry, I want to thank you as always, and we will likely reconvene this again. And I'll look forward to working that out with you. This program will be archived either later tonight or early in the morning, California time, for all of you who are interested in getting it up and running. And thanks again, and listen, you and I will obviously stay in touch, and we'll continue working out a little bit of a different type of program next time based on Linda's suggestion. We'll see how far we can take that in a sort of a modified space show format. All of you, thanks for calling and emailing and for your participation. Everyone have a great rest of the weekend and a terrific week. And may your Super Bowl team win if you are actually following the game. Again, goodbye from Barry, goodbye from me, and the Space Show. Keep looking up, everyone.